In Ezekiel 38 and 39, it speaks of a great invasion of Israel in the end times. Most people believe this is going to be led by Russia, together with a lot of Muslim nations. And there are some problems with this, because most Bible prophecy scholars, until you came on the scene, believe this would be the next major prophetic event. But the problem is that in Ezekiel 38 and 39, it says over and over that Israel will be living securely. It says that in, for example, verse 8 of 38. In verse 11, they will be living without walls. In verse 14, they will be living securely. And that is not the situation in Israel today. And yet people have said, well, it's just a relative thing. They're relatively living securely, but they're not. And so how could this be the next event when that condition has not been met? Also, there is a puzzling thing about the prophecy, and that is that when it names the Russian allies, it does not include any of the Arab nations that have a common border with Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You have come up with a solution to both of those. Tell us about it.
Okay, well, and it's interesting because, you know, with all the elbow rubbing that Russia's doing these days, the muscle flexing that Russia's doing these days, it does appear as though this would be the next prophecy to be fulfilled. And I did an article that you actually put in your Lamplighter magazine called Psalm 83 versus Ezekiel 38, which is the next Middle East news headline. And in that article, I discussed 6 to 7 reasons, I believe it was 6, but I found a 7th now that I'll share with your audience, as to why Israel is not in that condition yet for Russia to invade. Like you said, they're not dwelling securely. I have a chapter in the book called Israel Dwelling Securely, and the two Hebrew words are Yeshav V'Tash. And they're not dwelling securely. They are, of course, they had 4,000 rockets lobbed at them from Hezbollah and so on and so forth in the summer of 2000. And they're not dwelling without walls, which is another condition they have to be in.
Back to building walls.
Yeah, they have a 403-mile wall that at some point, that they're almost done completing, that at some point it's 20 feet high to keep the Palestinian terrorist element out of Israel proper. They are not dwelling in the center of the land. This is the new one I discovered. It says in Ezekiel 38, he's saying that Israel, this is brought up by Sheba and Dedan, when they're saying Israel is in the midst of the land when Russia comes against them. And the Hebrew word is tabur. And we have to wonder, well, what, and that means center in the language. We have to wonder, what portion of land was he really talking about? Was he talking about that portion of land allotted to the Jewish state in 1947 with UN Resolution 181 of the partition plan? Or was he perhaps talking about the land allotted to the Jewish people in Genesis 15:18, when God promised to Abraham that he would give them land from the river of Egypt to the river of Euphrates, which courses through Syria and Iraq, which would put the center of that land in Jordan? And I, as I get into the book, and hopefully we'll discuss some of this stuff, I talk about how Israel will annex land and find themselves in possession of Jordan. It appears to be from several scriptures that I point out in the book. They're not dwelling securely. They're not one of the wealthiest nations in the world. They haven't acquired the exceedingly great plunder that Russia also comes after. We're given a hint as to the motive of Russia, the consortium of Russian alliance that comes against Israel. They're coming for exceedingly great plunder. Some suspect that since Israel is drilling for oil these days with Zion Oil, that they will come into a newfound wealth of oil under their own soil. And they might. And there's a lot of Zion oil, there's prophetic oil is out there, and they tie in connecting passages of the Old Testament where they believe it was foretold that Israel would find oil. However, I don't think it's going to be limited to that. I believe it's going to be the exploitation of Arab resources as Israel expands in and they conquer over Psalm 83 Arab nations, which I'm sure we'll
be
talking about.
You mentioned Psalm 83, and that's where we're getting to the heart of what you have written about. Ezekiel 38 and 39 says that the Israelis are going to be living in peace without walls when this Russian invasion occurs. That is not the situation now. Secondly, it does not mention any of the Arab nations that have a common border as being part of the invasion. Why aren't they there? Now, you suddenly hit the scene with an answer to both of those questions concerning Psalm 83. Now, how does Psalm 83 answer those questions?
Well, yes, David, it is intriguing that Israel's most observable opponents over the last 60 years since the restoration of the nation are not enlisted in the Ezekiel 38 nine-member consortia of nations. And this has puzzled the scholars a lot recently. And these are the very nations that border Israel through which the Russian invasion would be trespassing into to get into Israel to invade. So, of course, why are they not listed? And, of course, what we're referring to is Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and their, and what has evolved out of those entities, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinians, and other terrorist entities could be included in that list. 3,000 years ago, oddly enough, a prophecy that has not found its final fulfillment, Psalm 83, issued by Asaph, the seer, it enlists all of these specific populations that we're talking about. There's 10 of them in total. And in my book, I've gone through and traced who they are, because when Asaph wrote this prophecy, he was speaking in the vernacular of his time. He was talking about Edomites and Philistines and Tyrians from Tyre. Well, you know, who could he have been talking about? And it turns out he appears to have been talking about the Palestinian refugees, the Hamas, the Hezbollah. He talks about Assyria, which would encompass Syria and part of northern Iraq. He talks about the Hagarines, which Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum and myself subscribe to being. Hagar was the matriarch, a matriarch of Egypt. She mothered Ishmael to Abraham. So we look at them as the Egyptians. Ishmaelites, we look at them as the Saudi Arabians. And throughout the book, I weave in these connections of who these people are through the research that I've done. And they are absent from the Ezekiel 38 invasion. So I was intrigued by Psalm 83. And of course, the theme of the book is Psalm 83. And I talk about how this, and the psalm talks about these 10 populations coming together with one consent in an attempt to destroy the nation of Israel, that the name Israel would be remembered no more. So I look at that as an, and most scholars agree that event has not been fulfilled yet. So I look at that as a forthcoming event in light of the way we see the stage setting over in the Middle East presently. It answers the question, why aren't those nations included in Ezekiel 38 and 39? And then I get into how God deals with that battle. We'll probably be talking a little bit about in the interview as well, through the exceedingly great army of Ezekiel 37:10, which I believe the Israeli Defense Forces will fulfill that prophecy. So they're not listed in Ezekiel 38 and 39. They are listed in Psalm 83. And so I make a distinction between the two. Now, when the Israeli Defense Forces defeat, I call it the Israeli conquest in the book, and I call these nations of Psalm 83 the inner circle.
Okay, now wait a minute. Let's make sure that the viewer understands this. You're saying that Psalm 83 is a war that's going to be fought before the war in Ezekiel 38 and 39.
Yes.
And that it will be a war in which Israel will defeat all of these Arab nations that have a common border with it.
Yes.
And that, and Israel will expand into that territory.
Yes.
And therefore, that's the reason they're not mentioned in the Russian invasion.
Yes.
Okay.
That's four yeses.
All right.
We're on to something here.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. This
really
is my hypothesis.
And that solves the problem too, that of Israel having peace.
It also solves the problem of Israel moving into the center of the land, the midst of the land. It also solves the problem of them being exceedingly wealthy, because they will be able to exploit the Arab resources. I believe that it will be a safer Israel. More Aliyah will come forward. More Jews will come into Israel. They will exploit the resources and expand territorially. And they will be that, become that ripe carrot on a string that Russia and Iran look at their chops to come after for that exceedingly great plunder.
Well, I tell you what, Bill, when I read your book, and you sent me a copy before it was published, I was just sitting there saying, yes, yes, yes. I mean, this answers all these questions, and I couldn't understand why anybody, myself included, had never seen this before. Because I'd always wondered, why is it says Russia, they're living in peace, and these others are not mentioned as part of the Russian invasion. And it just, I think the Lord gave you an insight there, and it just pulls it all together and makes it so clear that the Israelis will fight this war, win this war, occupy these territories, have the peace, and that's why they're not included in the invasion. And Israel really will be living in peace. Well, I tell you, it's quite an insight, and I just get excited about it. I thank you for it. It's a really a great insight. And how has it been received?
It has been received fairly well, with scholars like yourself and many others. It's caused a lot of people to dive deeper into the psalm and try to understand it. See, the interesting thing about it, it is a petition. It's a prophecy put into a petition-only format.
That's right.
It's not like Ezekiel 38 and 39, where, as we say in California, you get the entire enchilada.
You're right, and it does raise a very important question, and the question is this. It never says in the psalm who wins this war. So how do you know the Israelis win this war?
Well, there's several reasons for that, David. And the very basic starting one, theologically, is that God promised Abraham that he would have descendants forever, and those would be the Jewish people. What we're talking about is a probably nothing less or nothing short of a genocidal attempt against the Jewish people by the Arab nations that we talked about, those 10 populations. God is a promise keeper, and he will not allow the Jewish people to be destroyed. Hitler was unsuccessful, and of course, the litany of attempts.
In fact, in Amos, he says, I'm going to put you in that land, and you'll never be rooted up again.
Exactly. If God keeps his promise to Israel, you know, which we know he will, then the Jews will win. But what connected this for me, David, is Ezekiel 37:10. You know, many people, Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum, myself included, believe that Ezekiel was transported in Ezekiel chapter 37, 2,600 years ago into the 1940s, where he saw the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones. And this represented the Jewish people in the diaspora in a devastating, grave Holocaust condition. And it says, and God even asked Ezekiel, can these bones live? And Ezekiel says, God, you know. What a profound question that turns out to be, because if they don't survive, the very thing we're talking about, God broke his promise to Abraham.
Okay, now, to a very important question, and we don't have much time. The question is this. Traditionally, Bible prophecy teachers have said that peace would come to Israel only when the Antichrist made a covenant with them that would guarantee their security. Now, you're saying the Israelis are going to defeat all of their Arab neighbors around them, occupy their territory, have peace, and become a world superpower. And they don't need an Antichrist to guarantee their peace. So what is the Antichrist covenant all about?
Exactly. The traditional viewpoint that has been taught for the past 60 years has come from the limited lens of a lesser Israel, in my estimation.
Mm-hmm.
Ehud Olmert said in September 14th that the notion of a greater Israel is expired, and then on the 19th, Ahmadinejad said the idea of a lesser Israel is about to be expired. I'm paraphrasing his verbiage. But the way I look at it is I look through the lens of a greater Israel. Israel is going to expand. They are going to come out of this little 9,000 square box that they were allotted with UN resolution of 1947, the partition plan. As a result of the Psalm 83 war, they're going to become an exceedingly great army. They're going to possess not only their arsenal, but they will have the opportunity to possess some Arab arsenal as well. They're going to be very powerful. I then say it is followed like a Goliath shadow coming in behind that comes Ezekiel 38 and 39, where Russia comes after Psalm 83, these nations. And in the process, their God exhibits his power, and he defeats that invasion. The purpose of the Israeli Defense Forces is only to deal with Psalm 83. They're not even necessary in Ezekiel 38 and 39, apart from perhaps burying the dead, burning some weapons, and things like that in the aftermath. God destroys them. So what we have, and I put these events pre-tribulational, and I put them, the Antichrist coming onto the scene, in the aftermath of both of these powerful genocidal attempts against the Jewish people. So we have to be looking at this when we try to understand the contents of the Antichrist pact with Israel.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be looking at it through the lens of a greater Israel, in my estimation. The Israeli Defense Forces exhibited their might, achieved the title, and fulfilled the prophecy of being a great army. God will have accomplished his purposes, which says that the Jewish people will recognize he is God, and the nations of the world will recognize he's God. And so what is the stage when the Antichrist comes on the scene in light of the fact that these two events could precurse the tribulation period? And some of the the most vast literature in the scriptures is in Isaiah 28. Isaiah says that this Daniel 9:27 covenant becomes a covenant with death, an agreement with Sheol. And it's a picture, if you read Isaiah 28, of the Jewish people in a very empowered condition. And they are intoxicated with their empowerment. All the way from Ephraim on through to the priests, the prophets, even the people that fight back at the gate, I presume that would be the exceedingly great army, they're all intoxicated with this power. So it says that when they sign this covenant in Isaiah 28:15 and 18, that they are expecting that an overflowing scourge that will be coming, well, they'll escape that scourge. So we have to ask, well, what is this overflowing scourge they could be referring to? Could it be the 144,000 witnesses have been running around talking about the day of the Lord's coming, the Revelation judgments could be forthcoming? Could it be the Gentile nations of the world are going to war and Israel's concerned about that? We've already talked about Psalm 83 occurring and Ezekiel 38 occurring. I don't necessarily see another war apart from the Armageddon campaign after that, although there may be some. Could it be that's the scourge they're worried about, that they want peace from that? But the traditional viewpoint has been, you know, that it's a peace between the Arabs and the Jews and or a protection for Israel from the world in general. But I look at it as a different way. Perhaps it's a protection from the world of an empowered Israel on some level. So, and then it goes on to say in Isaiah 28:18 that this covenant will be annulled and that the scourge will pass through. Now, we do also know that in the Armageddon campaign, the Antichrist is going to come forward and he's going to try to destroy the Jews. And in Zechariah 13:8, it talks about two-thirds of them being cut up. It'll cut off and being destroyed. So this could be the scourge as well. But they're thinking by signing some covenant with this individual that some overflowing scourge is not going to come their way. And, of course, God says that's going to be annulled. And it does say in verse 22, a little bit further down, that God has determined an end for the whole world. So it could very well be it's the day of the Lord, the day of Jacob's trouble, things along those lines that I don't know if they feel they could escape that. I'm conjecturing. I think it's a milestone to consider the possibility that it's not a peace pact between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but it's something much bigger and much broader. So I don't know exactly what the content is. I'm hoping to write another book and find that out someday.
Okay. Well, I hope the Lord gives you that insight very soon.